The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dan Klein. Dan teaches improvisation full-time at Stanford University, where he's on the faculty of the drama department, and the Graduate School of Business, where he teaches at the legendary D School. In 2009, he was named Teacher of the Year at Stanford by the Student Association. He has led customized workshops with a variety of companies, such as Cisco, Oracle, Nestle, Visa, and ING. Dan Klein, welcome to the show.
Thank you. So good to chat with you.
As you know, so much of our work in improvisation is grounded in making individuals more comfortable with discomfort and building resilience through a changed mindset around mistakes and failures. That's like DNA in our work. So I found it fascinating when I was researching for the podcast that your immersion into improvisation bloomed after you had a serious motorcycle accident.
That's almost true. I was a passenger in a convertible Volkswagen Thing.
Whoa.
My roommate and I were driving home, and we were rear-ended by a drunk driver who might have been going 100 miles an hour on a city street.
Uh-huh.
And it caused a serious traumatic brain injury.
Wow.
Where I was in a coma for almost a week.
Wow.
I definitely count that experience as one of the, going through that and recovering from that as being very formative. It had a huge impact on my, obviously on my life and career, but very specifically on my approach to improvisation.
So, and I imagine the term post-traumatic growth was not around when this happened.
No, I hadn't heard that. I was aware in general of sort of an American story to go through something hard and come out on the other end, this notion that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so I was generally aware that that was a concept, but not as a personal development framing and narrative technique. But I found that it was, I had taken an improv class before the accident.
Right.
I took the class from Patricia Ryan Madsen, who wrote Improv Wisdom, and I count as my mentor, the most important mentor in my life. And one of the things that she always did was she made it, the improv classroom was a safe place for us to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still pretty guarded as an improv student. I would still really think through the possible offers that I would make and evaluate them and judge them and critique them. And only if they got through my critical filter would I then say it out loud. But I learned that I should pretend that I was surprising myself because people seem to like that.
Hmm.
But I don't think I was really that first class. I don't think I really improvised much. Right. I was still pretty cautious.
And if the internet can be trusted for my research, and it can't be because it did say motorcycle what I saw, what I sort of saw too is like after the accident. So you had taken improv before, and after the accident, Patricia had you sort of like basically sort of AD, right, and work with her. This idea of the aspect of teaching to learn, I think, is really really crucial. How that goes deep. So I imagine that had something to do with it in terms of just allowing you that space to step back and see what's happening and teach it to then learn it.
Exactly. One thing that she always said, and I've heard this recently in other domains too, but Patricia said there's three ways to learn how to be an improviser. One is in the classroom. One is on stage in front of a live audience. and the other one is by teaching it. And she said, you can do all three right away, and there's things that you can learn from each one that you can't learn from the others. And I think that was exactly right. You know, but when I snuck back into improv class after my head injury, I didn't expect to get to be the teaching assistant. That was sort of an extra bonus. And actually, that quarter, when I was the teaching assistant, it really just meant that I was taking roles. And then every once in a while, I would meet with her before class, and I would get a little insight into how much planning she was doing and how much she was reading the audience in the class and what was needed. So I got a little bit more insight into, behind the curtain of what was going on for the improv teacher. And then it was after that class that Patricia decided it was time to create a performance ensemble at Stanford, which became the SIMPs, the Stanford Improvisers. And that's when we started doing it on stage as well. And then I got to keep TAing and learning more, apprenticing more as an improv teacher.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to meet Patricia this summer at an Applied Improvisation Conference.
Oh, terrific.
And she just exudes what all those sort of great classic improv teachers are made. There's a certain type. There's actually two types that I know of. There are these screamers and yellers, and then there's these sort of like sweet Buddha-like people. And Patricia Martin DeMott was someone like that out of Chicago. And she just radiates that kind of energy. So I can see how that was sort of affirming at that time.
Exactly. And it wasn't, honestly, if I'd gotten one of I've learned from the other improv teachers and learn invaluable stuff. But if a loud, outgoing improv teacher was my first teacher, I probably would have been too intimidated to continue.
Yeah, totally. I think that's actually we found that at Second City, that you really want your level A, your level B, your beginning classes to be people who are all about support, trust.
Yeah, a nurturing teacher that creates a great environment. Yep. Yeah.
And then to evolve, you then need those challenges. And we know this from our research into learning. So another person you got to work with is Carol Dweck, which I'm very jealous of. She's done pioneering academic work around this idea of a growth mindset. And I actually plucked out a quote from her book that I thought was just so smart and interesting. She says, after 7 experiments with hundreds of children, we had some of the clearest findings I've ever seen. Praising children's intelligence harms their motivation, and it harms their performance.
Yeah. It's really profound.
That seems like counterintuitive, but it's not if you've worked in improvisation.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, it's interesting. There seems to be in my generation, there was a whole emphasis on self-esteem. And so there were a lot of parents were praising their kids and everything that they did. And it seems to have created a fairly fragile, fragile generation, you know, one that is, has a hard time enduring setbacks. And this is new information that makes a ton of sense now in light of what we've experienced. There's some interesting thinking around this too. My wife and I found it when we were looking at raising our son, who's now 17. And punishment by reward is an interesting. There's a book by that name, and that phrase is a really fascinating concept. Like the more we reward people and generate a fixed mindset about how they, what their capacity is, the less likely they are to take risks and experiment and fail. Carol is a brilliant, not just a brilliant researcher, but you talk to any of her grad students in the psych department here, and they're in awe of how well she embodies, as a teacher, she embodies these same principles. How effective she is at supporting her students, by praising effort instead of intelligence or achievement, and by she lives these ideas that she writes about.
This is the whole mindset thing is so interesting considering the environment we're in right now. I was listening to I don't know, it was some podcast, and the academic, I believe it's Jonathan Haidt, was on, who talks about the conservative mm-hmm. mindset and the liberal mindset mm-hmm. and conservative wanting order, and the liberal mindset being open to new experiences, and recognizing that, you know, when we work best, we're in a sort of a dual state. We're able to go back and forth.
Right.
And I think, and this is a thing with Kahneman's work too, because I think what what improvisers are doing is they're doing system one, system two, back and forth all the time.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I saw that you did you have a podcast with talking about improv and those and the system one, system two.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get it to download.
Oh no.
And I'm fascinated because that's something that's just recently hit me, and I'd love to hear what you guys talked about and figured out, because I think that's what we're doing. We're giving people, in a sense, permission to explore system one and make use of it, but use system two to do it in a way that's productive, rather than having it just rule you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll get you the proper link. So we talked to Linnea Gandhi, who is works with Kahneman, and she's also worked with Richard Thaler, who heads up the Center for Decision Research, which is where we have our partnership. So,
neat.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a kid in a candy store, as you can imagine, being around all these brilliant behavioral economists and scientists, and you know, utilizing improv exercises as a way to sort of dig in, and it goes back and forth, right? Sometimes we're leading with the insight, and sometimes we're leading with the exercise.
That's right.
But I do think the sort of it's funny too, because I had an idea that I was going to a theory that I was going to throw out to you, and this is just based on my experience working at Second City for basically 30 years. So I have this theory that improvisation attracts very smart people who are lazy because they don't want to be bothered with memorizing a script. Okay,
yeah.
So go with me on this. But once their intelligence is given this new improvisational skill set, what we're doing is we're unlocking geniuses and putting them to work in the world.
I love that. I will go with that. That is not that is a unique insight that I hadn't come to over my years, mm-hmm. but I think that works. That's awesome.
Well, it's a type, right? So we see them come out of college. They come to Chicago.
Yeah.
They don't know what they want to do. They're probably, you know, middle class, and so they've got a little bit of money. Their parents are helping them out. They were B students, B minus.
Right, right, right.
And then they discover this thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's so empowering. And I mean, I was lucky enough to, you know, work at the beginning of the career with like Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell and Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Seth Meyers and all these people who just like, you see them now and you're like, you are bright lights. Your ability to sort of like translate the world into sort of comic voice. And I watched them develop that skill set. And it's happened for, you know, decades at Second City. And so like, what's the common?
Yeah.
The only common denominator is the training.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, you know, I think you get to work with a slightly different population than I do.
Yeah, slightly.
Right? Because my guys are, you know, I have a number of actors, but mostly people who take my classes are either they're taking classes in the theater department at Stanford, and genuinely these are people who love theater, who are interested in theater, but they didn't come to Stanford to be an actor.
Right.
You know, it's something that they want to keep alive in their life while they get a Stanford education.
Yeah.
So that's a different, slightly different demographic or motivation. And then I get to do a lot of exec ed, and specifically out of the business school at Stanford. These people are now the group I'm seeing are coming saying, "All right, I don't want to be on stage. I want to disrupt the business environment. I want to create the next innovative new technology or business model, or I want to change the world. And I know that I need to figure out how to be agile and innovative and respond to you know, this crazy current market and technology conditions that we're experiencing right now. And so I need these skills. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that, you know, performers that have them have something that I'd love to tap into, but not necessarily to be on stage. So that's an interesting. It feels like a slightly different group. Not to say that some of them don't genuinely, you know, want to be on stage and go try and make their way in the world as an improv performer. But the vast majority are seem to be looking for something a little bit different.
Yeah, well, I think it's an important distinction because what we have to remember is this is a baby art form, right? I mean, we're talking 65, 70 years maybe if you go with Compass Players. And I don't know if you know about the Sam Wasson book that's coming out called Improv Nation.
No, it sounds great.
You are going to love this. So Sam is a terrific author. He did the Fosse book that did quite well a few years back.
Yeah.
He has been working for the last 3 years on a History of Improvisation in America book.
Great.
And I helped him out. My wife and I sort of advised on the book. And it is a detailed and rich history. He got to interview Mike Nichols before he passed away. And the tension that exists in the book is really interesting. So he talks about sort of Nichols and May, this tension between perfection and disarray, being the tension that has gone through the history of improvisation to right now.
Yeah. That's really exciting. I can't wait for that. One of the things that really struck me from the way Patricia taught us improv was she said, look, this is, people can be sloppy about this.
Yeah.
You don't have to have memorized your lines. You don't have to do, rehearsals. Feels like an oxymoron for improv. Mm-hmm. Her book, the subtitle of her book, Improv Wisdom, is, something along the lines of don't be prepared. Mm-hmm. That means you have that much more room to take care of what you can take care of. You have to be on time. You have to be ready. You have to be there without your baggage. You have to be focused and disciplined. And you're right, it's attention. Some people want to just be casual and have fun. And some people recognize that. So in your performing company, do you guys do notes after every show?
It varies. I mean, we always do notes. It varies whether it is after the show or the next day. When we're in process, which is, roughly a 12-week process of creating a review, and we're using improvisation to get to scripts, there is absolutely notes after every show. And then basically, during the run of the show, the director will come in like 3, 4, 5 times just to kind of fine tune and that sort of thing. But it's funny too, because I've seen in articles, I just read this academic article on improvisation, and they're like, well, there's no director. I'm like, actually, in our work, there's always a director. You gotta have a director. And I think in most improvisation, the teacher is often the director as well.
Right. I think that's one of the places that I see that the tension show up is whether how disciplined people want to be. Like, you want to just do a show and then go out and celebrate, or can we sit down and work through the sometimes socially sticky process of saying this didn't work for me, or and how we navigate that. And I got some really great tips along the way from Keith Johnstone about how to think about notes and how to go about notes. And not use it as a time to discuss or argue or protect your ego, but to just be able to say what's true and acknowledge. Otherwise we can't really grow as a company. I think that discipline is essential, and even more essential with what is easy to perceive as a casual art form.
Yeah. So the corporate clients that we get to work with at Second City, because we have a pretty rich division that does that, they always respond to this when I talk to them about it, which is a key tenet of the director performer note giving session, which is just take the note. Don't fight the note.
Exactly.
And in fact, you don't even have to actually do the note. If you've got a better way, it doesn't matter. And so this idea of I do want to talk about parenting, because I don't think I really knew anything about improvisation until I became a parent. And I use that with my kids where I'm like, just take the note. I don't fight me on it. You don't have to it or even pay attention to it. I just want you in the moment to take it. And then normally what does happen is you think about the note a little bit and you find out what aspect of that you want to play with. And that is when you're talking about feedback in a business situation. That's huge.
That is huge. That's a very translatable skill that we bring, in a sense, from our domain into other domains. I think that's great.
I really enjoyed one of your TEDx talks where you talked about, although we live in this incredibly connected time and place, we're connected through handheld digital devices and social media, and what we lack are closer bonds. And I want you to talk to us about what you mean when you talk about sort of the human bonding system.
Yeah. Well, I feel like sometimes I tell people in a program, I say, in order to do great work, We need to form connections with the people we work with. We don't necessarily need to have a lifelong like partner. We're not saying we're going to live together and make a family, but we have to have a connection that's based on trust and respect in some sense. And we can form those really rapidly. And I talk about different channels that we do that. You know, it turns out that if we have success together and we don't argue over who gets credit, then we form a nice little bond. Mm-hmm. But if we fail together cheerfully without blaming each other, then we can bond. We can bond sometimes even faster. And so it's interesting that we go through these different channels. If we create something together and we share responsibility, if we share something, if we reveal something about ourselves and we don't feel like it's judged, we feel like it's accepted, then all these things cause us to feel closer and more connected. But I usually end a session by saying, you know, we kind of figured this stuff out because we know that in order to do great work, we have to have a bond. But it might be backwards. Like maybe the reason we do great work is so that we can have a bond. Hmm. Like the human bond may actually be the primary mover here. There was one time in class, I don't know if she built up to it or if she just said it as a casual moment, but I remember really vividly Patricia saying to us, it might be that our purpose here on earth is to take care of each other. Hmm. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. Like that it's not that I didn't believe that. I just hadn't thought about it on that level. And I realized that that's what we're doing in improv. We're taking care of each other. You don't know what's going to happen next. So all you've got is each other and you might as well take care of each other. The practical result of that, I find in our classes, I'm at this point now one of the teachers that teaches improvisation at Stanford. My colleague from BATS Improv, Lisa Rowland, teaches two more sections. And one of the things that we found is that the classes are totally packed. They're oversubscribed. There's wait lists every quarter. Same is true for all the classes in the D school, where we also get to share our ideas about the improviser's mindset. And I think the reason that the classes are so oversubscribed is because people feel connected to their classmates. They come out of class feeling like they have a group, they have a bond, they've been through something together, they've laughed, they've been nervous, they've shared stories, and I think that's the whole point. I mean, if that wasn't the point, then we probably won't have live universities anymore. We'll just do it online and distribute it. I mean, I think that we wouldn't have corporate retreats where people have to be in the same room, mm-hmm. Sharing and discovering things together, because it's a lot cheaper and easier to do it online and do it remotely. But we don't get anywhere near what we get out of doing these things in person. So that's why somehow that bonding thing seems to have caught a vein. I end up doing a lot of workshops that are based on those ideas from the TEDx talk that I did. I do a lot of exec ed workshops here at Stanford that will kick off a week-long program. And so I do a little bit about how people bond, and then I give people exercises. You know, a lot of them came directly out of improv training, whether it's doing a word at a time sentence or play a little
red ball.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes I play a game of remember that time we, and I have them do it saying yes, but, and disagree about the details of this fake memory, and then they do it with a yes and. Mm-hmm. And it opens up a lot of laughter and humor, but also connection and inspiration. And so they do a little session where they try out the different bonds, but at the end of the session, they'll have formed a nice connection with, you know, a dozen people in the room, and then for the rest of the week, it's built on this foundation. Like they already know and like people and like working with them, and so by the end, my theory is their evals and their sense of the value of the program is much higher because they have colleagues and friends that they got to spend a week with.
It's kind of like a pro-social nudge, you know.
A pro-social nudge, and if you get it right at the very top. And then you have a nice closing at the end. Then the overall the value of the overall session ends up going up.
Do Do you have you ever come across the work of the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells? Do you know him?
No.
So we got hired for an ethics and improvisation workshop. So I ended up doing some research, and he wrote a book on Christian ethics and improvisation. He's the vicar of St. Martin in the Fields in London, and I had him on one of the very first podcasts. And he got exposed to Johnston, so he doesn't come out of Spole, and he comes out of that. It's great. Yeah. It's great stuff. And he said during our interview, he said the chief problem of humanity used to be mortality, and now in the modern era, it's isolation.
Yeah, that gives me the chills. That's
I know.
Exactly it.
And again, like, look at the world we're in right now. Right, we are dividing ourselves. We are. I was at this. I was at a house yesterday for a young Muslim woman who wants to run or is running for a congressional seat here in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And me and all my – and I didn't know most of these people, but they're good-hearted liberals. And they're literally talking about the Trumpers or Republicans as Nazis. And I'm like, my God, what are we doing? It really is. And in improvisation, one of the things I've always loved about it is that it requires us to – you can't just look beyond your differences. Your differences are baked into the communication. And there's one of the ideas that we've talked about at the Center for Decision Research, Chicago Booth, around this idea of self-verification theory and understanding people as they understand themselves, which is a deeper sense than being even just others focused. It's sort of like, how do you see yourself? If I can get in there, that is going to be very pleasing to you and will allow us maybe to build something together.
Oh, that's really rich. That's good.
Yeah.
I do a little thing where I talk about, people are really good at finding connections over similarities. What do we have in common? And I think that there are people who are excellent at schmoozing. They can do the cocktail party social networking thing.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a lot of – sometimes when I travel around, people pull me aside and they go, hey, is there a way to get better at these, like, business social functions? Because I feel like I can do my job, but I'm expected to, like, network and socialize with people, and I don't know what to do for that. I think that there are – people who are really, really good at it, and they just naturally are able to find the things that people have in common. Mm-hmm. But the people who are truly masters at it are connecting over the differences. They're finding things, they're being curious and interested in the ways that people differ from each other, even if you have things in common. And that's so valuable for creative groups, because we know that the more diverse the group, the better the solution. It's not more intelligent. Like, it's a better predictor than the intelligence of the individual members is how diverse they are.
It's interesting. I had Ron Heifetz from Harvard on the podcast. I think just last week we aired it. And he actually talked about this and the idea that if you look in nature, it's the coming together of differences that create.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
This is an essential thing that like no. That is the way that the world and people themselves, humanity advances. So and not that it isn't difficult. We get all that. We've seen this in our stories. Since time began are about this. I really do believe, and I'm preaching to the converted, I realize here, that improvisation can change the world. But I really see it as an elemental practice. I have a feeling that's where it's going to go. And it's interesting because when we talked about how you, the kind of student that comes to you and where you are, And being at Second City, and I know I started in 1988, so it was sort of midway through Second City's evolution.
Right.
But the reality was we were the only game in town at the beginning, and what was happening was the students were starting to tell us what we were doing. So we would have a guy from the Army, and he's like, "You realize like this the stuff you're teaching is the stuff that we need in Foxhole." Or it was a corporate executive. I remember we had a guy from Leo Burnett who came and was like, "We're going to now send every creative who we hire to work through the classes." And so that's how we got into the corporate business, because these people who were just showing up at our doorstep.
Yeah.
And that's evolved into this other thing. But it was a very organic development. And I kind of feel that's why it wasn't ruined, because it was sort of allowed to gestate in this You know, right. We're the flyover city, so it's not right. on the coast. It wasn't about money, and right. there's no ownership. This is the other thing that I think yeah. is crucial inside the yeah. notion of improvisation.
Yeah, that's great. That makes total sense to me. You know, when I first started doing improv in organizations, I was connected to kind of a boutique consulting firm that was basically they were teaching sales training. Uh-huh. Kat Coppett is a wonderful oh, yeah. improviser who, you know, Kat, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
She was in New York for a while, and then she was in San Francisco, and she now has a theater company in New York called Mopco, and she's a brilliant facilitator and trainer, and she brought me in to a group called QBI, and we did the boss founder at QBI was a big fan of improv, and he recognized that improvisers made the best facilitators, that they were really able to, you know, read the room and make adjustments and be able to, make the participants look good and give them a good experience. And mm-hmm. so it fit nicely. But for much of what we did, we weren't really allowed to call it improv. We had to, he was right, you know,
yeah.
because people would get guarded and defensive.
Get scared off of it.
You know, we had to say, we'll do a rich, you know, interactive simulation. Like, we couldn't even use the word game. But I don't think that's the case anymore. And I know that you guys at Second City, you're branded as improv from the start.
Yep.
And so I think people now are looking for exactly that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still cautious. I don't say you're going to do improv, but I feel like I'm able to introduce this stuff in the context of improv and still make it safe for people to take risks.
Yeah,
knowing that some people are fine. They're like, yeah, good to go. Bring it on. And some people still are very, you know, they want to make sure that they stay safe in a social business situation. That's still, you know, I read that there's a lot of risk for them in the room, and mm-hmm. You know, try to give them some value and give them a chance to kind of scaffold their experience so they're taking small risks before big risks.
Yeah, we had to hide the improvisation for many years in terms of the corporate work. And
yeah.
I will tell you, it just basically in the last 3-4 years has been the major change. And I kind of feel that's because if you look back, Malcolm Gladwell was talking about this about a decade
right.
ago. Dan Pink was talking about this about a decade.
Yeah.
So I think it was being seeded by other people who were getting it. And now, I mean, that's the thing, you know, when I hooked up with Jennifer Acker and
yep.
you know, did some stuff at Stanford, and then the program that we're doing at Chicago Booth, it's like no one's laughing us out of the room, which was kind
no.
of a thing that yeah. might have and probably did happen earlier. But again, you know, the companies got it probably before and started realizing it. And I think the literature, and I'm curious about this, again, you're at a big fancy university. There is so little scholarship and rigorous academic work around theatrical improvisation.
Yeah, it sort of resists it in a sense. I have a feeling that the you know, you're right, it's a very young, it's a young art. Even if you I find that my students are better served if they try to study it academically or intellectually, then they're probably actually just using that as a defense, and I need to get them into practice. That was actually my experience with it. I know that I had a defense, which is to try and be clever or try to be thoughtful and figure it all out. And,
right.
and part of my training was learning to step in and not try to solve it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a little bit of a resistance to the academic treatment of it.
Right.
But I got to read a book recently. You probably know, I'm sad that the author's name's just escaped me. Caitlin McClure. Do you know Caitlin? And she has a partner who helped write a book on, they were case studies on applied improv.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's wonderful. I think it's really exciting because it's a book in an academic tradition that's nicely, you know, resourced, but it's showing the practical value of doing improvisation in very, very different contexts. So some of them are business oriented, yep. and some of them are, you know, in other phases of education, working with kids in various conditions, and also, you know, there are examples that take place in the global community. And I think that I see that as an opportunity as a teacher to say, oh, here's another resource that I can direct people to show how this world is expanding, particularly with the applied improv. The key though to all of it in a sense is to make sure that we don't lose the source, that we don't lose the, you know, putting on a show mm-hmm. that hasn't been written and is created in front of live in front of the audience is the key. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's easy for me to let that slip away, but I think we need to be continually pushing that as well. Like not pushing our boundaries of that. Yeah. Like it's easy for an improv show to get really safe if you just play the same games over and over. And I think it's important to be pushing that the art form as well. I'm sort of saying that out loud. To push myself.
I know exactly what you mean. Right? Well, that's why you do that. That's why you say it out loud, because it is it's the doing and this idea of the sort of Adam Alter. I read a great paper, NYU professor, around cognitive disfluence, and it struck me. It's like, oh, well, that's improv at its best is these, it's completely new patterns. And it's playing at the edges. And there's a great phrase by the improv teacher Rick Thomas from Second City where he talks about falling into the crack in the game. So always Ooh. Kind of searching for that area that is, you know, it's not even there. And then you suddenly find right. yourself there, and it becomes, this is the difficult thing, and you know, you and I have sort of like grown up around this stuff, and I have kids too, and as you get older, you've got a mortgage, yeah. you've got all these things, it becomes yeah. increasingly harder to play in that space. So you have yeah. to kind of, and this is the TEDx I just did was around this idea of strategic discomfort. Yeah, how do you find Ooh. Ways to make yourself uncomfortable in a practical way to continue mm-hmm. to innovate? And I think this yeah. is where I think about choice architecture as being a kind of a field where that when that's combined with improvisation is you really just need to have both environments and behaviors that support practical discomfort. And so that you can work great. It into your week.
Love it. That's great.
So, okay, so I could talk to you forever, but what we'll close with is what we ask everyone, and this is like the biggest layup for you probably possible, which is asking you for a yes and story, a time in your life yeah. when you normally would have said no, but you actually said yes and.
I don't know if my answer is quite going to be fair. I may be cheating a little bit on this, but it's most recent in my mind. So I get cool opportunities, you know, to I'll often talk about John Stone's quote about people who say yes are rewarded by the adventures they go on, and people who say no are rewarded by the safety that they attain. Mm. And I think that it's been a nice guiding principle for me. And I try to say yes and go on adventures. But I very specifically here in October, my calendar just got too full, and I made I told my family and I said I am saying no to anything that comes up now, mm-hmm. and I asserted that, and I said I'm just going to say no. And literally that day, I had coffee with a former student and who is a journalism student from Ukraine. And he said, you know, we've translated David Kelly's book, Creative Confidence, into Ukrainian, mm-hmm. and we have a book release, and David doesn't travel. Is there any chance that you would come to Ukraine, come out to Kiev? And I just said yes. I just said it immediately.
Yes.
I got back yesterday. I was there. I mean, it literally, from the day we had coffee until I flew there was probably, you know, 2 weeks.
Wow.
And I feel like, This work, who knew? But this work has given me a chance to see the world and to meet people, and it's given me, in a sense, a mission, which is to spread it as far as I can, to learn about it, continue to learn about it while I spread it around the world, and I feel like this was a really clear example of me getting to take advantage of the adventures that come from saying yes.
That's a great story. I love it. Dan Klein, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I want to talk to you more, so I'll look forward to more opportunities.
Absolutely. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.